Hi, this is Leanne, and you're listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast.
This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix, right here, right now.
Now, you know what it's like. You've got a pie in the oven, your hands are in the washing up bowl, and the phone goes. So you dry yourself off, stomp over to the phone and angrily pick it up. And then a voice from long ago drifts into your ear and all your troubles seem to melt away.
Hi, Ollie, it's Lee.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing really well, thank you.
If it's okay with you, I want to go right back to the start and find out how Karen Lynn Greening became Leeron the Metal Queen. Was heavy rock always a driving passion for you? How did it come about?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, I grew up, I think the heaviest record my mom had was an Anne Murray record.
Oh, wow.
Well, very, very traditional, very Canadian, right? So no, I didn't grow up listening to hard rock at all. My parents, you know, from wherever they came, their backgrounds and where they came from, they weren't exposed to a lot of music themselves. So the music in our house was quite limited when I was a young girl. But a cool thing happened right around my, I guess, 14th, 15th year of age. My dad arrived home with a trunk full of vinyl because he used to work at a college in the Toronto area. And that college decided that year that they were going to get rid of their vinyl library. And I guess they were moving on to cassette tape. They changed formats. And so my dad arrived with this trunk full of records. And in that pile was Elton John, David Bowie, Fleetwood Mac, a lot of the popular stuff of that time, you know, the mid-70s. And Heart, I remember seeing that Dreamboat Annie record going, who are these women who are writing their own songs and singing and playing amazing and are so authentic? And I was enamored with all of this stuff because I'd never really heard it before. And that was sort of formed the landscape of what I kind of grew up with then. And that simultaneously that year, I was performing in a musical theater production. And a bass player from a local band came out and saw the production that I was in and thought I had a powerful voice and asked me if I would audition for his band. So that was the beginning for me. And I remember I was only 15 years old, so my father drove me to the audition. He wasn't about to let me go, you know, unchaperoned. And at first, all the other boys in the band were kind of like, you know, I don't know. We weren't really thinking that it would be a chick that would be the singer in our band. They ended up calling me and telling me that I had the gig. I guess nobody else, you know, could sing as well, or for whatever reason, I was invited to join this band when I was 15 years old. And then everything changed. Then I was introduced to a whole bunch of stuff that I had never really heard before. We did Zeppelin covers, you know, and Joplin covers in the very first incarnation of Leanne.
Wow. So you were singing Robert Plant songs when you were 15, 16.
That's right.
Now, around about this time, I don't know whether it was around about here or shortly afterwards, you had a pretty bad car accident, didn't you? What happened there?
Well, let me preface this by saying that this sort of what you're about to talk about was sort of misconstrued in the media back then. I was in an accident when I was 17. My dad was driving. My face kind of got banged up. My nose was broken. My teeth went through my lip. But they packed my nose and it healed and everything was tickety-boo.
Right.
And a few years later, I was doing an interview with a journalist at my record label in Toronto. And this guy had no car and he needed a ride home. So I gave him a ride back to where he had to go. And he was joking around about my driving skills. And I said, well, I think I was 24. And he said, you know, I said, I just got my license this year. And he said, well, why is that? I said, well, I was in an accident when I was 17 and I was fearful of getting my driver's license. That was fairly traumatic for me. And I said, my face got sort of banged up. Well, somehow he spun that into me having facial reconstructive surgery.
Right.
And I was like, so no, this is the face my mommy and daddy gave me and it's never been reconstructed. And
well, I should say at this point, when I put on the Facebook page that I was going to be interviewing you, there was, how should we put it, an outpouring of admiration is about the best way I can put it.
Aw, well, that's amazing. I was doing a show two summers ago. I was in the Toronto area, and I had a couple of guys, they were like university professors, who flew over to see my show in Toronto. And I was only playing like a 400 seat club, but they flew over from Britain. And I was so, I don't know, it was just so thrilling for me to have a couple of fans that came all that way to Toronto, because it was the closest I was going to get to them for a while.
I was going to talk about the number of female rock bands and artists over the years. I've spoken to a few, Lita Ford and Girl School and Rock Goddess, who thankfully are all still doing what they do. And there do seem to be a lot more than there were when you first started. Do you think it's easier now because it's more accepted, or was that not actually a problem for you? Is it easier to be accepted in a rock band if you're a girl now?
Yes, I would say yes. I think it's much more accepted now for a girl to just pick up a guitar and rock and write her own songs. You know, we were all kind of stuck under this umbrella of the corporate record industry in the 80s, which was very marketing minded. And if you were a girl who was even reasonably good looking, there was a real push to market you in an objectified way. And certainly for myself, I mean, I have to say, and I don't even want to use the word victim, because I never considered myself, I hate victim mentality, and I've never thought of myself like that, but I was definitely part of that wave of thinking, I'll put it that way. So certainly in the 80s, you know, I felt that to some degree I was battling against the images that were put out there for marketing superseding the importance of the music.
Right.
And I find that that is lesser now, but that has to do also with the record industry sort of falling apart, so that there isn't the marketing dollars to do that aren't there anymore.
Yeah. And that does take us on to another question I had, which was to do specifically with Metal Queen. That was the breakthrough album, I remember. That was the one that brought you really to my attention. But ultimately, that record and perhaps the perceived persona that went with it, was that both a blessing and a curse for you?
Well, it was a blessing in that it certainly got people's attention. It was definitely a iconic type of image. The curse of that was that it was also a cartoonish type of image. So I guess I would have to say timely as opposed to timeless.
Right.
But again, once again, I think the image almost superseded the music.
And was that, I mean, again, was that image something that was pushed upon you at the time, or was it an idea which then got spun out of control, or how did it, did you feel a bit out of control with it?
How do I explain it? The idea of putting a strong female persona out there was certainly in the cards. That was my idea, but it was an idea that kind of spun out of control. You know, I showed up for the video shoot and/slash photo shoot, and I showed up and there was a costume that was rented from this store in Toronto called Malabar's, and it was this sort of gothic warrior princess. It's like pre-Xena, by the way.
Right, absolutely.
The next thing you know, I was in this outfit going, oh, so this is what we're doing? Really? You know, a lot of this stuff happened to me too when I was very, very young. You know, so when I've got like the 45-year-old record executive telling me that this is what we think is what, how we want to sell this, and, you know, and we're investing the money, you know.
what followed it obviously was Call of the Wild, which was a great record. You were working with Bob Ezrin, who obviously is of much renown. How was that process for somebody reasonably young in the business?
I was pretty intimidated by him because, right. You know, I mean, he had done Alice Cooper and Pink Floyd, you know, so it was an interesting process. What had happened on that album is that we had originally started producing the album with our former producer, Paul Gross, who had done Metal Queen with us. And Paul was injured during the recording process. You know, he actually had a racquetball accident and almost took one of his eyes out. But and Bob Ezrin was recording this. It was some compilation album that he was doing with a bunch of major rock artists in the 80s. And he was in the Studio B next door. And he kept popping his head in to see what we were doing over there. And so when Paul was injured, Bob went into my record label and said, I would love to finish the Lee Aaron record because I've been paying attention. I think he liked my voice and I liked what he was hearing. So Bob sort of stepped in partway through the recording of that album, and he definitely put his Bob Ezrin stamp on that record because that's what Bob did, right? He brought Dick Wagner up from New York. Dick came with a song or two. So all of a sudden Dick was involved in playing on some of the tunes. And I think I learned a lot from working with Bob Ezrin, just in terms of, you know, and he's, I don't know what you call it, a bit of a mad scientist when he gets in the studio.
Yes.
So it was really great for me watching his processes while he was working. And a lot of the stuff was very immediate. And I know at one point he locked me and John Albini, my guitar player, out of the control room because him and Dick were, you know, hatching some plan for the beginning of the mix of one of the songs. And so it was all wild. And you got to remember, it was all the wild, crazy 80s. And so cocaine was still flying left and right. And so it was equally enlightening as well as intimidating for me to work with him. In the end, I feel so blessed that I got to work with, you know, like a master like him. You know, I was only 22 years old, so it was pretty amazing.
Wow. Now, the mid-90s was hard for any rock band to be taken seriously, and for a lot of them, even just to carry on because of grunge. You kind of responded to that by switching genres, not just a different slant on what you were currently doing, pretty much to jazz. Can you talk about how that came about? Was it directly because of what was happening with the musical landscape?
It was somewhat of a response to that. I had gone independent. I'd left my label in 1992 here and gone indie. But we borrowed, my manager and lawyer together, we'd borrowed like hundreds of thousands of dollars to, you know, continue on and to start this new imprint. And when grunge really, really took hold, yeah, you're correct. Everybody who was associated with, even remotely, with corporate or commercial rock, it's like we all fell off the edge of a cliff and died. I mean, you couldn't get the media or the media or television or radio to touch you at that point in time. So in 1996, I had to go bankrupt because, you know, I just suddenly, my manager sort of took a new job. He became a foreign licensing rep for Koch America, stopped taking my phone calls, and a bunch of banker boxes just showed up on my doorstep. And I started going through them and went, oh, I'm almost $500,000 in debt. Sweet. Now what do I do? I ended up going bankrupt in 96 and I took a year off. Yeah, that was a fairly dark period for me.
Yeah.
And when I, you know, I was kept being encouraged by friends to go back and start singing again and get back on a stage, but I had no interest whatsoever in, you know, just going full on and trying to be, to ride the pop culture media wave, or, you know, again, it wasn't something that I was interested in doing. Besides, you know, there's always some 19-year-old out there ready to kick your butt. So it's hard to compete, right? I mean, that's the reality and the nature of the industry. Everybody wants something that's fresh and brand new. So I just started singing jazz and blues locally in a few little clubs just because I missed being on a stage. And I'd always loved that style of music as well. What I didn't expect was, very quickly after that happened, a bunch of local papers came out. They started reviewing my show. I started getting a lot of press. And then it started to snowball. And the next thing you knew, I was getting invited to do jazz festivals here. And people were saying, when are you going to record this style of music? And because I had sung this style of music when I was younger I did a lot of musical theater. I think for the most part, people realized it wasn't just me trying to establish myself doing something new. It was an authentic passion for me.
Right. The first time I saw you was in 85, actually. You were supporting a nice bunch of lads called Bon Jovi. Was touring Europe different than North America in terms of audiences or just the general way things went? Was it better? Was it worse? Or no difference?
You know, I had never seen rock fans so crazy as when I came to Europe. And then that's the nice thing, too. It seemed to me that fans in Europe seem less, especially rock fans, less caught up with pop culture and influenced by that, that there was this sort of huge underground movement that was alive and well at all times with rock. And, you know, a perfect example of that was my third album, which was produced by Bob, which came out simultaneous right around the time of that Bon Jovi tour. We were released on a small label at the time out of Belgium called Roadrunner.
Mm-hmm, yep.
And within a short few months, we sold over 100,000 albums. And we were kind of like, our heads were spinning. We were like, how did that happen? Because it was very word of mouth. And, you know, if you put out a quality record, it caught on like wildfire. People found out about it. And so there was a passion to the fans over there that I never saw in North America. They lived, ate, and breathed their music. And it was a beautiful thing.
Let's get up to date then. Fire and Gasoline is due out this year. It's the first, specifically, I guess, rock album since Emotional Rain in 94?
That's correct. I always knew I'd make another rock record. And a decade ago, well, a little over a decade ago, 2004 and 2006, I had my daughter and then my son. So I became a parent. And I don't know if you're a parent, but it takes an incredible amount of creative energy to raise your children. So while I managed to put out a few DVDs and things like that and still perform a handful of shows a year, the amount of energy that it took to actually focus on writing and recording and completing an entire record project. I mean, it is like, you know, writing a book or any body of work. I just didn't feel that it was the right time.
Well, it's interesting that, because a question I often like to ask artists who've been away for a while, and it's great to ask people who've been away possibly because they've started a family. Having children is obviously a life-changing experience. Did you find that came into what you were writing about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think all of our, you know, experiences throughout our life shape us. And, you know, if you're an artist, you know, who creates original work, whether it's music or art or, you know, literature or whatever, that's going to creep into your writing in some way. So absolutely. You know, the song Tomboy, that was written for my daughter. 'Cause I'm a tomboy, tomboy. It's a song of empowerment about being free to be exactly who, to be your core self, to be your truest self. You know, there's a song on the album called Popular, and that is all about one of my big concerns in life, believe it or not, right now with my kids, is just that, you know, this whole social media culture that we live in.
Hello, it's Solo Friday. Love on the super highway. Talk to me. Make me feel
You know, I guess I sound like an old fart when I talk like this, but this culture of instant gratification, of these nanobite conversations where they're just having fewer and fewer actual human interactions with each other. They're all, you know, even in the same room, they text each other. It's crazy. It's ridiculous, you know.
Okay, well, I mean, it's your album, so it's your choice. Which one of those would you like us to play alongside this?
I would say I have a couple, either Fire and Gasoline, the title track, or a song called Bittersweet.
Fire and Gasoline is the 2016 album from Lee Aaron, so go and have a listen. It's quite poppy in places, but it's definitely a rock record, and there are some marvellous vocal performances, as you'd expect, but above all, some great new tunes. Of the two Lee picked from that album, I've decided to take things down a notch and go for the anti-love song, Bittersweet.